All right, this time we'll call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Time is 1:17 on Friday, March 11th, 2011. Members present are Representatives Kawasaki, Gardner, Representative Dick, Representative Heron, Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Seaton, and myself, Co-Chair Feige. The purpose of our meeting today is to take up House Bill 105, the Southeast State Forest, bill sponsored by the governor. We'll also continue our work on HB 106, the Coastal Management Program, with a sort of a brief walk through the LBNA audit on that particular program. And then towards the end, we shall hear House Joint Resolution 8 to oppose genetically engineered salmon by Representative Kawasaki. Okay. For the committee, we have House Bill 105. This will be our third hearing on the bill. Online, we have Rick Rogers from the Division of Forestry and Marty Parsons from Division of Mining, Land, and Water, if any of the members have questions. This time, is there any discussion or amendments to this legislation? Representative Wilson.
I do have an amendment that I'd like to put forward. Amendment number one. I move amendment number one.
I'll object for discussion.
Okay. And what this amendment does, there's two parcels, Rowan Bay and Hook Arm, and this isn't in my district, but I've had people ask about these, and they have told me that there's some prehistoric heritage sites in or around these areas, based on the Alaska Heritage Resource Survey, and some pink salmon streams, and karst and cave resources. And on the Rowan Bay parcel, it has two salmon streams and numerous heritage sites within the parcel, including the prehistoric Rowan Village. So based on the location of these two sites, I'd like to make it just makes sense to do a carve-out for those two parcels.
Okay, amendment number one has been presented. Representative Kawasaki.
Is there somebody from the department to speak to it?
There is, we got Marty Parsons and Rick Rogers from DNR.
Then to them, Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
To whomever can answer the question, I have a question on how those parcels were originally selected and if it would, if the department would object to removing them from the Southeast State Forest consideration.
Mr. Parsons or Mr. Rogers?
Rick Rogers, through the chair, Representative Kawasaki. You're asking how the parcels were selected for inclusion in the state forest?
Yes.
Okay. The parcels were selected for their timber resource values and the fact that the area plan, both the Central Southeast Area Plan and the Prince of Wales Area Plan, for Rowan Bay and Hook Arm, respectively, designate those lands in the general use category, which means they are part of our managed timber base. Both of those plans do acknowledge both the anadromous fish habitat resources on those parcels, as well as the heritage resources on those parcels, the area plans, as well as the regulatory regime that we work under acknowledge those. The Forest Resources and Practices Act provides very generous riparian set-asides by statute that are required, 100 foot on each side of those anadromous streams with respect to the heritage resources. Before we do a timber sale, we prepare what's called a forest land use plan, and that is basically supports the best interest finding to proceed with a timber sale. And in that process, we consult with the state historic Preservation Office, the SHPO, which is also a agency of the Department of Natural Resources under the Division of Parks. And so we work closely with them, and we think we can accommodate the heritage resources, and obviously we would have to adapt our plans accordingly based on the specifics of those sites. I guess finally, the area plans call for typically in southeast a 500-foot coastal buffer as well, and our past experiences, the bulk of the heritage sites typically are within 500 feet of the coast. That's primarily where people have settled and used the land. But if that was not the case, then there'd be additional conditions put on the timber sale before it was moved forward. And I guess finally, the statute for establishing state forests also requires a forest management plan, a state forest management plan that would need to be prepared within 3 years of passage of this bill. And so that, again, would allow us to take a more detailed look at any multiple use, you know, other resource issues that might be involved on the two parcels in question or any of the parcels in the package.
And follow-up, Representative Pozick?
And then the second part of the question was whether you thought the department would object to removing these pieces.
Yes, the department would object. We've vetted this internally, both with the governor's office and with multiple agencies within the department, as well as the Department of Fish and Game, and have concluded that it is our wishes to put the bill forward as drafted.
And let the record reflect, we've been joined by Representative Foster. Representative Wilson?
I would like to question the department a little bit further. So you're saying that you took these things into consideration when you decided it, and there still are more than one chance for these areas to be discussed by the people that would be concerned in those areas?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's correct. There's probably more than one chance, actually. The first chance would be in the state forest management planning process, and then the second chance would be any of our timber sales through the forest land use plan. They also go out for public review and comment before a best interest finding is approved to proceed with the sale.
And follow up. How much time do they do? You know, altogether, how much time is included in that so that there's plenty of time for public comment?
45 days. I think it's a 45-day review, Representative Wilson.
Each time.
Correct. And then there's also processes for reconsiderations and appeals. It's the normal regulatory process that DNR uses for public involvement in its best interest decisions for disposals.
I think I will... withdraw.
One more question.
Oh, okay.
Representative Seaton?
Thank you. I'm just trying to follow. That's the same procedure because these lands right now could go for timber sales, as I understand it. I just want to clarify. And so that if you conducted a timber sale now, that would happen. And if it was in the state forest, the timber sale, the management plan would still have to be there, and it would go through the same process. It would be the same restrictions, but the difference would be that if it's in a state forest, then you can anticipate some long-term stability, so it would be on more of a rotational harvest, and you could do pre-harvest thinnings to improve the productivity of the forest. Is that the only real difference between the two? I mean, if these are in there, or if these are out, there could still be a timber sale on the land with the same kind of requirements. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that is correct, and I think you've characterized it correctly.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Well, I'm going to withdraw my amendment then.
Okay, amendment number one has been withdrawn. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I intended actually to offer to introduce this amendment, and while my staff was working on it, discovered that Representative Wilson was doing it, so I did not. So I would like to offer an amendment, and it's probably a futile activity, but nevertheless, I want to make the effort to offer the same amendment in my name, because and I think it's worthwhile.
We do have a committee rule that amendments need to be in 24 hours prior.
Mr. Chair, this amendment was in at the time, or met whatever, and as a representative and a member of this body, I have a right under our uniform rules to offer an amendment.
Okay, brief it is. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I understand that the original sponsor of this amendment had some ambivalence about it, but I don't. I think that there are elements here that are important to protect, and I want to do that, and that is particularly the Alaska Heritage Sites. Those are irreplaceable, and the amount of land in question, the bill before us, doubles the amount of the state forest lands. I want to support the bill. But taking out these two specific heritage sites are a total of 7% of this bill, only 7%, 3.4% of the overall forest lands. And they're just, you know, heritage sites that I think we should be protecting as a state.
Okay. Discussion on Amendment 2. Representative Wilson.
I am torn in this because we have a timber industry that we're trying to keep together in Southeast Alaska, and something that I was not aware of at the until actually a week ago yesterday, that because I had a bill that will affect less than 1% of all of the timber in Southeast Alaska. And so I thought, oh, that's no big deal. But when I was talking to the forest industry, they informed me that of all the timber in Southeast Alaska, they've only been able to cut not quite 2% of the timber. And so the numbers that we're talking about, when we think less than 1% or, you know, it sounds like it's not a big deal, but it is a big deal. It's a very big deal. And to me, the fact that it doesn't make any difference whether the same rules will apply to these parcels, whether they're in it or whether they're out of it, makes me want to, I guess, let it go. And the reason I pulled my amendment was the fact that there may be parcels of that of those that was, I think it's over 1600 acres, close to 1700 acres that this involves, and some of their areas are much smaller areas in this whole situation. And if we pull the whole parcel out, then we have cut down on the amount and of the possibilities of the timber. If we leave it in, I'm thinking that when they go through the process, they will be able to set aside those certain areas, but not the whole thing. And that's what I'm concerned about, because we do. It's a very tight line that we're looking at, and. I am pulled both ways, and so for that reason, I guess I'll vote against it because it can be done in smaller areas rather than those great big areas.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We don't have a situation here where not including this gives a higher level of protection for the land. In fact, I think it gives a lower protection of the land because it's not going to require the timber harvest plan to be developed in the same method for the state forest, and all of the sites are going to be protected at least as adequately under the forest under the state forest designation. There's nothing in the state forest designation that gives DNR the ability to trash any sites or do anything else. All of those things must be protected. The riparian guidelines are there. The setbacks from the water's edge are there, as well as everything else. So it seems like if it's in a state forest, it's got long-term protection because then we have a designated use. If it's under general use, it could be go through land disposals or other processes. I think we've seen these before, in fact, on transfers to university land sales and those kind of things. So putting it into the state forest will actually, I believe, give greater long-term protection status to this land than leaving it outside in general use category. So I'm going to oppose the amendment because I don't think there's anything that the state forest designation will put at risk those heritage sites or anything. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Kawasaki.
Thanks. I guess that's my question to the department, if that is the way it's seen to, because we have had the University of Alaska Lands Bill in front of us several times, and we seem to pick apart each parcel, and then we want to put covenants on certain parcels and things like that. And I guess if that's true, then I would support Representative Seaton's comments. But I'd like to hear from the department on it.
Okay, Mr. Parsons and Mr. Rogers.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, that's correct. I think the way Representative Seaton described it is accurate, that these lands will have longer-term protection under a state forest than under a general use designation in the area plan. I also just want to note that the area planning process that's already taken place also was, you know, a lengthy public process with the opportunity for public input, the opportunity for any disenfranchised parties to appeal the decision. The area plan, if you look at the language for both of these parcels, it does talk about heritage resources in the plan, and it clearly gives direction for DNR to protect those areas. The planning document's not the place where you're going to have all the level of detail necessary to make the site-specific decisions. Typically, those a lot of the information is housed at SHPO, and a lot of the information is actually kept somewhat confidential to prevent looting and some of the problems that you can have with heritage resources. But as part of our process, whether it's in the state forest or not, we will consult with SHPO, and we will do what's necessary to provide adequate protection for the heritage resources under the guidance of the state Historic Preservation Office.
Thank you.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I have a question. If it's part of the state forest, these two parcels, then they're managed primarily for timber production. That's part of the definition. And does that not make it more difficult then to make these prehistoric historic sites part of a refuge or state park or defined for other public use?
I don't think it would make it any more difficult to protect the heritage resources on these sites if it was in a state forest. You're correct that a state forest is the guidance language for the state forest puts some emphasis on forestry resources, but it is still a multiple-use management, and clearly, just to be consistent with state statute and regulation and federal statute and regulation, actually, for heritage resources, we have to protect those. We have the mechanisms in place and the office here at DNR to help us meet that objective.
Thank you. I have one more question.
And I guess, yeah, finally, I guess what the state forest designation does that that kind of helps the situation that I think Representative Seaton was getting to is that it keeps the land in state ownership, whereas if it's general use land, it may or may not stay in state ownership. It could be disposed of. It could go to a university or someone or a DNR land sale, et cetera. So I think it gives us a little more certainty that the state's going to hold on to those lands, including the heritage resources, and then manage them accordingly.
Follow-up, Representative Garner.
Thank you, and thank you very much for your testimony. What designation would give these prehistoric historic sites the greatest protection from destruction or damage?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, this is Marty Parsons, the Deputy Director for the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. The designations that keep those lands within state ownership are going to give us the greatest protection for those prehistoric resources. You know, there's no particular designation that would say, you know, a historic resource, but by putting it in a state forest or in habitat or some other type of designation would take it from being conveyed out of state ownership. I think one of the important things to remember in these prehistoric sites are they are anywhere from 1 to 2 acre sites in a 1,500 to 1,600 acre parcel, so it's a very small percentage of it. And with the planning process that takes place developing the area plans, the Division of Forestry will be held to a fairly high standard as to what they can and cannot do, and they will have to protect those areas as part of their planning process.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, one more question.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. So is there any designation other than forest lands that's a greater protection?
Well, Representative Gardner, through the chair, the forestry is a management intent. We have general use, you have habitat, there's settlement, there's several other designations. I think the thing that we to remember here is that by putting it into the state forest, it retains those lands in state ownership. And so by retaining it in state ownership is going to give those historic sites the most protection.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
So within state ownership, the most protection is what the bill does as it's written?
What, Representative Gardner, through the chair.
Just a yes or no would be fine.
Yes.
Thank you. Then, Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw my amendment, which I guess hadn't actually been moved, but wherever we are, I'll drop it.
Okay. And just for the record, amendments are due 24 hours prior to a committee meeting to where they'll be offered. That's so everybody has the opportunity to fully understand amendments. At this time, I'll be, Chair, I'll entertain a motion to, first of all, is there any further discussion on House Bill 105? Representative Dick.
Yes, I remember a testimony while we were listening to this. There was three fellows that called up on one of these parcels and were objecting to turning it over to because they felt that the value added and they wanted to build furniture in the local. Am I in the right? I think I am. And I tried calling each one of them, the phone number that I was given, and I wasn't able to get a hold of them. And I've since been caught up in the tsunami of my own. But anyway, I did make an effort to get a hold of them. I wanted to hear from them better. I was wondering if anybody, maybe particularly Representative Wilson, do you have any idea what was the situation there?
Representative Olson?
If I remember right, it was talked about in committee, it was going to be everything, I think it was a large percentage already is kept, like 85% or something is already kept in Alaska, and just some of the parcels that were the furthest away might be sold in the round, but by far the largest percent is in Alaska.
Representative Dicker?
Yeah, I'm trying to recall clearly. There was one community, I can see the map in my mind, where there was three individuals called up, and all three felt that they did not want large-scale logging in that area because they felt like there was enough small business in that area that they could do the value added and it would actually be better for the whole community. And, again, I should have persisted more in follow-up. I just don't want to disrespect those who called in and testified. And, again, I did try to get a hold of them, but I was just hoping somebody here had a greater insight.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up again, the putting this in the state forest or leaving it out of the state forest does not mean that there won't be a timber sale.
Yeah. Okay.
Timber sales are part of the general use multi designation. So the thing is that this would put it onto a longer term rotation status. For management purposes, putting it in the state course.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, let the record reflect. We've been joined by Representative Munoz. And this time, is there any further discussion on House Bill 105? Representative Chief.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 105, Version A, with individual recommendations and attached to their official note.
I think I made the full motion.
Yeah.
And hearing no objections, House Bill 105 was moved out of committee. Now we'll take a brief at ease while the bill gets signed. Time we'll reconvene the House Resources Committee, and next up is House Bill 106, the Coastal Management Program. We'll be getting a briefing on the recent LBNA audit from Pat Davidson, the legislative auditor. Welcome aboard, Ms. Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Pat Davidson, representing the Division of Legislative Audit. Good afternoon. Based on the legislative request, we conducted an audit of the Alaska Coastal Management Program. Usually when I do a briefing of audits, I sort of cut right to the chase and talk about conclusions. But with this one, I'm going to talk about the background a little bit first, mostly because, as you're finding, this is a very complex program. And the controversies surrounding the program are found in the fine details of the program, not the broader overview. So to help put the findings of the report into context, I want to go through a little bit of background information first. It starts with the foundation of the program starts with the Federal Coastal Zone Management Act of 1972. This program was intended to promote the effective management, beneficial use, protection, and development of the coastal zones. States' participation in this program have the right to review federal agency and federal permitted activity occurring or affecting the coastal zone. This act encourages but does not require the participation of local governments. Alaska's coastal management program began in 1977. In 2003 and 2005, there were statutory changes that substantially modified the ACMP program. Some of those changes included transferring the development and the implementation of the ACMP program from the Coastal Policy Council, sometimes referred to as the CPC, to the Department of Natural Resources. It revised the statewide standards. It removed the Department of Environmental Conservation from consistency reviews for the most part. It required coastal districts to rewrite their district coastal management plans. So there were a substantial number of changes there. The cornerstone of the ACMP process is the consistency review. So what's that? A consistency review determines if a proposed activity is consistent with the statutes and regulation of the agency's resource districts, resource agencies, sorry, and those agencies are going to be DNR, Fish and Game, and Environmental Conservation. Whether it's consistent with the statewide standards, which are established in statute. And third, if the activity is consistent with the coastal district's enforceable policies. These criteria are collectively referred to as ACMP's enforceable policies. The process of a consistency review starts with a public notice. Then the division distributes the consistency review packets to the review participants. And those participants would include the resource agencies involved, in the affected coastal district, the applicants, and any other interested parties. The division collects comments regarding consistency from the review participants and then distributes those comments to all the other participants. They facilitate discussion among the review participants to achieve consensus, and then they render a proposed consistency determination with alternative measures as necessary, circulate it, and then there's a final determination. That's what the consistency review process is. What's going to be key is the criteria that's used in determining whether that activity is consistent or not. And going back to it, it's whether it's consistent with the resource agency's authorities, whether it's consistent with the statewide standards, and whether it's consistent with the coastal district's enforceable policies. As the bureaucratic process goes, it sounds relatively easy. The complexity and the associated controversy come into play with the establishment of the statewide standards and the enforceable policies that the coastal districts can establish. Going through the conclusions in our report one by one, first, we found that the regulatory changes in 11 AAC 112 and 114 are within state law and legislative intent. For those of you that have copies of the report with you, the description of legislative intent is found on page 24 and 25, or excuse me, page 23 and 24. We also found that they have limited the ability of the coastal districts, however, to establish enforceable policies. Since the new regulations have been established, coastal districts have submitted 490 enforceable policies, and only 210 have been approved. Many of these denials are based, at least in part, because, one, the coastal district has not sufficiently documented a matter of local concern, and that concern is not adequately already addressed by a state or federal law. Or secondly, that the coastal district could not provide a map that met the written scientific evidence requirements to support an area being designated as an important habitat area. The thresholds for designated areas which require scientific evidence are difficult and expensive.
Excuse me.
And
Representative,
where are we in the document here?
If you're looking at the first report, I've gone through the background information section, and now I've moved into the report conclusions, which begin on page 19.
Representative Wilson?
As you move from page to page, could you tell us? Because I've got mine. I've got them highlighted, but I...
Okay. Certainly. Okay, certainly.
Thanks. Please continue.
Thank you. Okay. It's on page 20 where we're talking about the changes in the number of enforceable policies. maybe answering a question that wasn't asked to me, but this is where we had talked about that prior to the 2003 and 2005 changes, that there had been over 1,300 enforceable policies. And what we had found out is after that time, there have been 490 enforceable policies proposed and 210 have been approved. That is a substantial drop. However, there's a reduction in the number of participating coastal districts. The other item that has dropped the just raw numbers of enforceable policies is that one of the changes in the law is they wanted to get the enforceable policies to be as clear, concise, and non-duplicative as possible. And so also, besides looking at the new ones that hadn't been approved, the major drop are going to be found with regard to just eliminating duplications, that there's a coastal district that would have an enforceable policy that was the same as a state statute or a regulation or in federal law. One of the other places we saw where there's duplication is that there had been enforceable policies coming out of the coastal districts that were with regard to federal land. However, they don't have the authority to establish enforceable policies on federal land. And so there's a large drop in the number, but what we focused on in this audit is looking at the number of enforceable policies that had been proposed, and we're looking at the reasons why they hadn't been approved. The other thing that we found happening is that if a coastal district's enforceable policy had been denied, there might be more than one reason why it had been denied, that it could have been both already addressed by a state or federal law and that it didn't have additional scientific evidence to meet a designated area.
Just a point of clarification, the CRSAs can still submit areas for consideration, correct?
I mean, Mr. Chairman, they can propose them.
Okay.
But it is part of the division's responsibility to go through there and ensure that those enforceable policies do not duplicate a state authority or a state standard.
But it's not like there was a period to do this, and now that period's closed. The period is always, it's always open to being amended.
You are correct, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
If you look on page 22 of the report, you'll find we did a comparison by region about the number of proposed district plans and the number with approved district plans. As I indicated, the thresholds for those designated areas which require scientific evidence are difficult and expensive. And while the DCOM does, the division does provide some funding to the coastal districts, scientific evidence and creating the very specific maps is probably more expensive than they are getting in that grant money.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is do you feel that there's any reason why the local communities can't hire their consultant with that grant money? I mean, maybe it's a statute regulation or something, but if that, could we just change that? Because I think in some of those areas, if they could take that money, because it does take a lot to do this, if they could take that money to hire a consultant that could help them do it, it would be much better.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the issue that we had brought up, it's in the part two of the report, but going to that issue, we had concerns and expressed our recommendation that consultants be allowed to represent the coastal districts. Our point was that many of these coastal districts are political subdivisions, and it really isn't within the authority of a department to decide what a political subdivision can do in operating, you know, its own entity, whether they decide to hire people directly, whether they choose to consult, hire through consultants versus employees, that delegation is a matter for that political subdivision or that coastal district to determine on its own, and that it's while the agency is trying to foster good participation in the program by the stakeholders of the community, we believe they overstepped by trying to prohibit those coastal districts from being able to be represented by consultants.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. In the development of those 490 plans or enforceable policies that had to be redone, my understanding that there was a lot of guidance issued by the state in before those were submitted. And I'm trying to figure out, is there some reason why so many of these were rejected when they were, my understanding is they were based on the guidance that was given by the state for the development of the plans, and even some were preliminarily okayed, and then they were rejected. And was there changes in the guidance? Is that what we're looking at? Or what was the background of the rejection of so many of the new enforceable policies that were developed by the district?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Seaton, I don't know that I have a direct answer for you. We didn't look at all of them. And we did know, for the ones that we did review, the common themes that we saw coming through had to do with establishing that matter of local concern, as well as not duplicating a state standard or something already covered. I think one of the areas that was highlighted when we talked with some of the coastal districts was that if a resource agency has a state standard addressing an issue, but they have not adopted any regulations to further define what they are or aren't going to do or accept, the lack of a regulation doesn't mean that has not been adequately addressed. So if you have and I know I'm explaining it in the abstract and it's a little difficult. So if you have a state statute that says you're responsible for something, you've not put into place any regulations that define how you're going to deal with it. When it comes to the coastal district's ability to write enforceable policies about that issue, that issue is deemed to have already been addressed. And so a coastal district cannot sort of fill in the gaps where there is no regulation.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you. So basically what I'm hearing you say is that the state ignored the word adequately and said if this could be addressed by an agency, therefore it's been adequately addressed, even if coastal district has concerns about something, as long as the ability is there for the state to address it, then the word adequate just didn't have any play at all in this as to whether the specifically for that area the coastal district had concerns, but they were just out of the ball game. Is that what I'm understanding?
To the chair, Representative Seaton, I think that's a good paraphrase. I'm not sure that the word adequately is, I can't remember whether the word adequately is in statute. It's that they can't be duplicative of an authority of the state agency. And so I think it's deemed to have been addressed if it's in statute. I guess one of the best examples I can think of is when we look at DEC regulations for spill and spill containment, looking at the issues that DEC does, is they're going to expect a plan in place from the person or entity proposing an activity if that spill could be over, I think it's either 5 or 10,000 gallons, barrels, sorry. I've messed that one up before. That would have been adequately addressed spill issues. A coastal community can't come in and say, I'd really like to see a plan if you only spill 1,000 barrels, because DEC has already said this is where it's going to be. This is what we require. And so the local districts can't come in and put any additional requirements on that.
Thanks.
All right, please continue.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. My mistake.
Yep.
Representative Herron.
At page 22, Exhibit 8, and I read the sentences referring to Exhibit 8. But my question is footnote 28. Did you drill down in your audit in relation to footnote 28?
Mr. Chairman, I can see some questions. That was page 22, the footnote on the bottom.
Mr. Chairman.
Everybody got that?
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Herron, in Exhibit 28, what we are trying to do is identify the proposed versus the approved designated subsistence and important habitat areas. And the reason the Northwest is so low is because you have to have a management plan in place and approved before you can start getting your enforceable policies approved. And it was the lack of approved management plans why those were not being approved, why those enforceable policies, as opposed to there was an issue with the policy itself. We are trying to make that designation.
I fully understand that. Did the audit drill down into 28 is my question. Did you try to figure out why those plans were not approved in the audit?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I know one of them at least had been in the commissioner's office and had asked that its determination be suspended. I know that that's the case for one of them. I don't remember what it is for the others.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, is I guess the question is, these approved district coastal, yet to be approved district coastal management plans, they were, why haven't they been planned? Did the audit drill down into that?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I guess not to your satisfaction. Again, other than the fact that one of them we know was in the commissioner's office and they asked that it was suspended, but other than that, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Would you like us to request that, perhaps? Because it seems pertinent.
Yes, sir. I'll work with your offices to ask that question.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. Please continue.
Okay. Moving on to page 25. That as intended by the legislature, the DEC carve-out has excluded air, land, and water quality permit issues from ACMP reviews. One of the provisions of Chapter 24 of SLA 03 was to remove air, land, and water quality permit issues, water quality permit issues of under DEC's authority from the ACMP consistency review process. This removal or carve-out did two things. First, it allows for DEC to conduct its permit review process concurrently rather than consecutively as the ACMP review process. Since some of DEC's permits take an extended period of time, industry particularly like the concurrent permitting aspects of the DEC carve-out. The DEC carve-out also functionally eliminated the opportunity for any coastal district to develop enforceable policies related to air water quality air, land, and water quality permit issues for permits issued under the authority of DEC. The ACMP process allows local coastal districts to have a say through enforceable policies on projects going through a consistency review. However, this voice has essentially been shut down by DEC carve-out for these air, land, and water quality permit issues. Also, I would note that in the 2008 reevaluation project that was initiated by the division, one of the proposals was to eliminate that DEC carve-out.
Representative Seed.
Thank you. On page 25, that second to the last paragraph, where we're talking about that the DEC carve-out has reduced, or well, it's the opinion of the industry, I guess, that DEC carve-out had reduced delays in consistency review process. Did you look at that to see whether that was correct?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, when we looked at some of the projects, I don't think we are looking to see whether it was delayed, but what we could see is that the timing of the DEC permits, because they were going concurrently rather than consecutively, did start earlier, which should allow them to also complete earlier. Particularly with DEC, some of those permits, I think it's the air quality issues, can have a very extensive time period to get that permit. So just being able to overlap those processes was more efficient than it was before.
Follow up, Representative.
Thank you. And can you explain to me where in the consistency review process DEC was previously at the tail end or something, so that it's not a consecutive process, so that it's sequential? I mean, I thought the purpose of the consistency review was so that everybody was at the table doing their things not consecutively, but in coordination, or we're reviewing those things. And what I'm hearing here is the idea that DEC is held off until the end, and either the permits aren't applied for till the end, or there was something physically in the process of the consistency review that held the DEC's permits off instead of them being coincident with the other permits.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, what they can do is they can get to the end of the consistency review process, learn whether there's any alternative measures, learn if there's any other enforceable policies. They can get to the end of that process before the DEC permit process has run, whereas before, when it was part of the consistency review process, you had to wait till both of those pieces were done until you found out whether your project was going to be consistent or not. And so you still have to there are still some issues. You have to still have all your permits, but you're going to know the results of your non-DEC issue. You have an opportunity to know the results from the non-DEC issues before the DEC piece has been completed.
Thank you. Follow up. Go ahead. So within the way the system functions, I'm just restating to make sure I understand. You have the consistency review process, and you're going forward, and let's say DNR and ADF&G and whoever else is concerned and at the table is there, and they're working on their projects, and DEC has got a longer time frame, hasn't had enough personnel to work on the permits. For whatever reason, DEC has got, let's say, an air quality permit going and hasn't determined that that permit will be granted. And so we come through the process, and since previously you have all your permits tied together at the end, so when the consistency review is done, everything's ready to go. Mm-hmm. In this case, you could get there to do the consistency review. You can go ahead and do it and say everything's ready to go, but you still got to wait on DEC on the same time frame that DEC is going to take, no matter whether they were in the process or not. I mean, whether they were at the table or not, because their permit is taking however long it's going to take, either way. Is that?
To the chair, Representative Seaton, that's right. And so you will know whether your activity is going to be in accordance with state standards. You're going to know whether it's within the enforceable policies of the ACMP program. So you'll have, as a applicant, you'll have that determination. You're still going to have to wait for your DEC permit, but if there's anything that you need to mitigate, anything that you need to work on, you'll hear about it. You have an opportunity to hear about that faster. If it is one of those DEC permits that would take the extended length of time.
And follow up, but go ahead. And so the other agencies, you've got DEC, and is DEC then, it permitting process, is it going to be, it's not going to be exclusive of the other agencies. The other agencies are still going to be able to comment on the DEC permit. Is that correct? I mean, not in the consistency review for the project permit, but DEC isn't going to be able to get away from consulting with ADF&G just because it's not part of the consistency review. I mean, is that correct? I mean, ADF&G is still going to get to consult on those water issues with a DEC permit if it's a water quality issue.
To the chair, Representative Seaton, DEC is going to follow its own regulations for issuing permits, and if that requires consulting with the other resource agencies, it would. There's also the public comment process included in all of the in general permitting activities that go on. And so one of the key differences here when you look at the coastal districts is coastal districts have an opportunity to make public, to go through the public comment process with regard to the issuance of DEC permits. However, in the ACMP program, if they have an enforceable policy, that enforceable policy has to be given due deference, which means they need to be in compliance with that. However, if the coastal district has a comment on that DEC permit issue, it's just a public comment issue. It is not given due deference.
Please continue.
It is a complex program.
Yes, it is.
On page, let's see, on page 27 is our conclusion with regard to determining if the revised statewide standards have limited the ability of the agency to meet the ACMP objectives. We found this was very subjective and very difficult to measure. We found that many of the changes clarified the standards and eliminated duplicate authorities. For example, one of the things they changed was the wetland definitions and redefined it to meet the federal definition. Just makes more sense that way. While DNR believes that the ACMP objectives can still be met through comprehensive application of state resource agency statutes and regulations plus state standards, some of the resource agencies expressed some doubt, particularly in the areas of habitat standards. In our one of our review of some of the reports and the literature with regard to this program, we observed that NOAA's review, they encouraged DNR to demonstrate the effectiveness of the standards in protecting coastal habitat by monitoring how these standards are implemented through permitted projects. Basically, NOAA can't tell DNR to change state standards, but they are suggesting that the outcomes of these standards bear watching. And then our final conclusion in this report starts on page 29, and that is that we found that the ACMP process has not diminished the state's rights under federal CZMA program. The state still has rights with regard to federal agencies or federal permitted activities within or outside coastal zones that affect the coastal zone of Alaska. The state has rights to evaluate the consistency of those federal activities with the state's enforceable policies. However, to the extent that the state has limited the development of enforceable policies in designated areas by coastal district, it has also then generally limited its extent to comment on federal activities on those same issues.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 26, I'm not sure I understand it's the third paragraph down. From what I gather, districts do have the right to evaluate a decision, and when they do, they get to talk directly with the commissioner, and it's informal, and it occurs within 45 days. And then it says, however, DEC appeals process usually involves the hearing officer, is formal, and can be lengthy. Are you saying that you probably think that it should be done within 45 days also?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, one of the points we're making here is trying to identify what the effect of the DEC carve-out is. Coastal districts don't have enforceable policies. However, on water, land, and quality permit issues under DEC's authority, they do for the others. If a coastal district believes that a consistency determination has been made and they disagree with it, they don't think that their enforceable policy has been given sufficient due deference, they can elevate that determination to the DNR commissioner. And we talk about it, it's resolved in 45 days, and it's a more of an informal process. Compare that with a DEC permit issue where their enforceable policies, they cannot write enforceable policies that are given due deference. The only thing they can do is make a public comment. And if they do go through that process and they try to appeal the DEC decision to issue or not issue a permit, the process for appealing or elevating is the term used in the ACMP process, is different. It goes through the hearing officer process, and it is definitely a more formal process. So we're just trying to show that comparison about what happens, I guess, to the voice of the coastal districts under DEC permitted activities versus activities that go through the consistency review process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand that. So how should it be changed? I'm asking, should that decision, you know, because it says it's length and it can be lengthy. Are you saying that maybe there should be a rule that says they can do, but they can do that, but they have to do it within 45 days? What are you saying? You're saying that they're not equal. So how should we change it?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think the point that we're trying to make is to discuss the impacts of what happened when the DEC carve-out was done. I think that's where your question is. Given those parameters, are you still happy with the DEC carve-out? Does the legislature want to maintain the DEC permitting activity outside the consistency review process? Because when it is, this is what happens. Or do you want to bring it back in, and then those things would go back to what they were before? So I don't think that we're so much trying to focus that the DEC appeals process is good or bad compared to the elevation process in the ACMP. But when you're evaluating whether or not the DEC carve-out is working as the legislature intended, that's one of the impacts of it.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
And I guess what I'm saying is it may not be an either-or thing. It may be that we just need to tighten up some of the regulations or loosen them one or the other. The carve-out, in my way of thinking, isn't necessarily, well, we keep the carve-out or we get rid of it. Maybe we can get some compromises in here and make it something so it's more livable. So I think that there's more room for work on it besides just an either-or. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay, thank you.
Just for my clarification, when you talk about enforceable policies mm-hmm. within the coastal zone, you're talking about local laws.
Mr. Chairman, for the most part, no. The Alaska's process for developing coastal districts' enforceable policies is an alternative to these entities, most of which are political subdivisions, from developing local ordinances. So they go through a process not of establishing local laws or ordinances, but these enforceable policies gain their enforcement because they have been accepted and approved as enforceable policies under the ACMP program.
Representative Seed.
Thanks for going to my question. Just on that, there were a number of districts that when these changes were going to go in and they felt they were going to lose their ability to make reasonable enforceable policies, they incorporated their enforceable policies in borough ordinances, borough municipal ordinances. So with that being the situation, and like Representative Feige was indicating, local laws, if they've incorporated their previous consistency review, ACMP, local enforceable policies into ordinance, does that then mean that the project developer comes forward and goes through the consistency review, and at the end of that, or could even be simultaneous with that, they then would have to go to the borough and get the borough's permit in a separate action?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, one of the things this is going to be a little long-winded answer to that question. One of the things we did is we made a comparison of Alaska's program with four other states. It's on page 18. Because there really are two ways of doing this. You can do it the way that Alaska has primarily done it, which is to that local governments participate in reviews and that the comments of those local governments, to the extent that they're enforceable policies, are given due deference. However, when you look at California, Florida, Louisiana, and Texas, are local enforceable policies part of the state coastal plan? And in a lot of those cases, the answer is no, because those states have, I guess I'd say, more experienced, more well-developed local governments, and they're just dealing with it on the local level with local laws and ordinances. To the extent that that is happening in Alaska, we haven't done a lot of work in that area, so I don't know how to answer that question because we didn't drop down to the local governments. But to the extent that they're given that authority under Title 29 to develop local laws and ordinances, then that would be an alternative way of doing it. So to the extent that you have major frustration possibly by some local governments or coastal districts that are also local governments, I guess that is one of the options for them to do.
And just following up on that, did you look at how many of the municipal districts did adopt their enforceable policies as local codes so that those permits are required now?
To the chair, Representative Seaton, no, we did not.
Okay, thank you.
How I would say, and it doesn't go to how many of them have done local ordinances, but on page 6 of this report, we do have a small map, and we have identified the coastal districts and identified which of those are no longer or are not currently participating in the ACMP. Many of them being cities.
Oh, I know what my question was before you got off on that.
You got it under control.
I got right. It back again.
Representative,
I was trying to remember where that was. Under the DEC process, where a coastal district or the municipality has to go through the administrative hearing process. As I understand it, the administrative hearing process is there, and then it goes to Superior Court if they disagree. Is that the process we're talking about here under the DEC carve-out, is that you have to, you know, if you have problems with it, you go hearing officer, and then that appeals to Superior Court?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I don't know the process off the top of my head. I don't know. I know that you go through the formal appeals process, but I know that the avenue takes you to court. I'm just not sure of what all the steps are.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please continue.
Thank you. I'm going to move on to the second part of the report. We found that the ACMP program is operating openly and transparently in general. However, there were certain areas where that openness is lacking. For instance, there was no recording or minutes taken for some of the working group meetings. DNR limits its distribution of consistency review materials, and DNR has not kept participants actively informed in the status of the ACMP evaluation process that started in 2008. And I do want to bring to members' attention, we're not talking here when we're talking about are they open and transparent. This isn't a question about are they following the Administrative Procedures Act. We're just looking at it in terms of, is there good flow of information? The consistency review process takes a lot of active participation. And if you're going to have active participation, communications is going to be essential to that. And so that when we are looking at this, this is not to say that they're not complying with the Administrative Procedures Act or any statute or regulation. So what we were asked to look at is, was it open and transparent? And that's where our comments on that issue come from. We found that DNR's policy of not allowing a district consultant to represent the district on a consistency review disregards the autonomy of the coastal districts. And we believe that the state agency telling another governmental unit what can and cannot be delegated is overstepping its authority. Sorry, page numbers.
What do you want? Mr. Chairman?
I'm sorry. I started on page 19 with the conclusions.
Okay, page 19 of
Part 2.
Now, we've got a flurry of questions coming up from Representative Herron.
Pat, I know you're on to underline number 2, but going back to underline number 1 about lacking certain aspects of open and transparent, and you know you articulated that they were operating openly and transparently, but what was their reaction to you when you pointed out certain things like the minutes? And in a since then, Mr. Bates has said that they're going to start taking minutes, but what was their reaction to some of your observations?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, all our reports contain the agency's response, and in its response, mostly they talk about. I would say they generally disagree with our observations. They talk about what they're required to do, and I don't disagree with the fact that what we're suggesting here or our conclusion about openness and transparency is not directed towards not complying with a regulation or not complying with the Administrative Procedures Act, because that's not the issue. I guess I would just I hate to put words in agencies' mouths, so I would say in generally they didn't necessarily agree with us.
I'm not questioning whether they agree with you. I guess no question or comment to you, Pat. But Mr. Chairman, this strikes me as unusual that the department operated. I'm not saying they're operating that way now, but it seems like they operated in with to the letter of the law, but not within the spirit of the law. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I probably would agree with those last comments. I feel that their disagreement was purely because they felt that they were being attacked, and they're saying, no, we're doing everything according to everything that was said, you know. But for a little bit better ease and feelings of both sides, they could have done it in a way that wasn't so confrontational, and I think it probably could have done to make the districts feel like they were being listened to instead of saying, nope, that's the rule, and that's the way it is, you know. And I think it could have been done in an easier way. And I think they were defending that they didn't do anything wrong because they're doing exactly what the law said. So I think you were right in your conclusions there.
Mandate a cooling off period. Representative Seed.
Thanks. We received comments that it wasn't only that things weren't recorded, but that people that wanted to record were told that they could not in these meetings. Did you receive those same kind of comments from district participants?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes, we did hear those things too.
And I guess I'm somewhat confused, and I don't know what the response was, but it seems to me that the entire purpose of the consistency review and the enforceable policies was to have a coordinated action, and so that people could understand. And when you're talking about not allowing consultants, so that you had to have people that were less familiar with the process. Was there any explanation given to the audit auditors as to why there was prohibition on recording the minutes of the meeting so they could be shared with the other participants in the coastal district?
To the chair, Representative Seaton, I remember there were discussions about the consultant issues. I don't remember that there was a lot of discussion about recording or not recording minutes. So I don't know how to answer that. You know, our discussion about the consultants had to do with the goal of the agency to have members of the coastal districts, you know, being actively participating, you know, not delegating that out and so on and so forth. But again, our view on that one was it's still up to the coastal district to decide what they want to do.
Sure. And I guess my only comment, Mr. Chairman, or my thought here is trying to figure out how we expect somebody from the coastal district who is not, you know, necessarily integrated into the format of an agency decision and how decisions are being made if they can't record the conversations and the minutes and everything and share those with the people in their community with their trying to work. You know, it just seems like that's some of the frustration that I've heard from coastal districts is it's like we're supposed to be lost in the woods and that they couldn't figure out the process. And so basically you heard some of those same comments when you were interviewing them, but I'm not asking for a conclusion. I just wanting to know if you had heard those same kind of things.
And through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes, we did. It does seem like in a lot of these areas you get at cross purposes between your actions and the intent. If you're going to have, you know, a dynamic process, people have to be participating. And if you want people to participate, you know, you have to make it as easy for them as possible to participate and to understand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. A lot of the focus is on the coastal districts and the enforceable policies and the interaction of the districts with the ACMP process. And I was wondering, did you have a chance to talk with applicants, project applicants, about their experience with this process and the pros and cons of that process before and after any changes have been made in the last few years?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz. We did. We talked to representatives of various industries. I will tell you, with long audit experience, the people that are unhappy talk to us more than people who are satisfied. It's easier to draw them out. And so you're right. To the extent that the report talks more about coastal districts and their concerns, there's going to be two things sort of driving that issue. One is the request that we were actually given to do the review and the fact that where people think they need or want changes in an agency, they are going to talk to us more.
Please continue.
Thank you. Now I've moved on to page 21. Let me see. Okay.
Before we go on to 21, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
I noticed on the second paragraph after the line about it's the fourth paragraph down where it says DCOM maintains two distribution lists for project reviews. And I wasn't quite able to figure out what the two distribution lists were for and whether that facilitated communication or got people at cross purposes.
Okay. through the chair, Representative Seaton. I don't know that we were trying to identify that it was putting people at cross purposes. I think what we were trying to explain was who's getting the more saying who's getting the material than drawing a compare contrast sort of issue.
Okay.
So moving on to the question about whether DNR is the appropriate agency. In analyzing the organizational placement of the Alaska Coastal Management Program, we found that ACMP's mission is aligned with any of the three resource agencies, DNR, Fish and Game, as well as DEC. Also, because the program coordinates activity among departments, the other agency that could manage the ACMP program and actually used to would be in the Office of the Governor, so that our conclusion is that DNR is one of the appropriate agencies to administer the ACMP program. We found that the changes in Chapter 24 of SLA 03 have centralized decision-making in the DNR Commissioner's Office and have lessened some of the consensus-building aspects of the ACM consistency review process. Some of the changes that contributed to that lessening of the consensus-building aspect included the elimination of the Coastal Policy Council, the reduction in the number of district enforceable policies, transferring the program from the Office of the Governor to a resource agency may have strained or tweaked the noses of some of the other agencies' participants, and that DEC is not as strong a participant since the DEC permits have been carved out of the consistency review process. And our final conclusion with regard to this report is that we concluded that the legislature should reauthorize the ACMP program, that the program gives the state the formal influence on federal decisions regarding coastal zone projects. Additionally, it coordinates permitting and consistency reviews for projects and developments, which aids both state agencies as well as private businesses in dealing with the state bureaucracy. The legislature could simply repeal the repealer section of the uncodified law, or alternatively, if the legislature prefers further evaluation of the program, our suggestion was that the repealer section could be modified and reset the sunset date to July 1st of 2015, which would be a four-year extension. This report also contains two recommendations. The first one we've discussed a couple of times. It's about allowing coastal districts to designate their own representatives. But secondly, there's two ongoing regulatory projects that are going on. One, neither of them are being completed in a timely manner. The first is for the division to complete the revision of the ABC list, which is already 3 years past the statutory deadline that was set out in Chapter 31 of SLA 05. The importance of this ABC list is that it identifies the categories and descriptions of uses and activities that may impact the coastal zone. It's these categories and descriptions that define what level of consistency review, if any, is necessary. And on page 17 of the second report, we actually do have a description of A and B and C activities. The second project that the division needs to complete is its reevaluation project that it started in 2008. While this project has no statutory deadline, there has been substantial investment of time and resources into this project, and the statutory and regulatory changes should be finalized with respective public and the respective public processes should be completed. That's it.
Are there any further questions? Are you sure?
No, you better be.
You thinking?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Herron.
Pat, the other day I asked Mr. Bates, what is the magic of 6 years? What is the magic of 4 years that you allude to? And what is the magic of 1 year? And he said, well, if we add them all up, 11 years would be just perfect. But I guess I'll ask you is, I mean, I can read what you said there, but there is no magic for 4 years?
To the chair, Representative Herron, I'm a numbers person. There's always magic in numbers. I would say that what we considered in coming up with our recommendation is we believe that the two regulatory projects, the ABC list and the completion of the reevaluation project, are important. There's been a lot of work done. They should not be that far from completion. The agency needs to complete them. Those changes may have a small or they could have a substantial impact on the program. So if we're looking, it's going to take them another 12 to 24 months to get those projects completed and implemented, and then another couple years to operate underneath those programs, then we viewed that 4 years would allow for those changes to occur and the program run under those and then come back again for a reevaluation at that point in time.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. There has been some question brought to us about problems, and you may have identified it, with the program being in DNR and the focus of DNR not being on this project as much as other things. When you looked at the not where it could statutorily fall, but where it would be most effective in being housed to be most effective, let's just say that. Did you get testimony on that from agencies as well as from individual coastal districts that have had, you know, previous experience when it was housed in the Office of the Governor?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we got a lot of comments about the way the program used to be and the way it is now. However, I don't know that so much of them had to do with the organizational placement in isolation as opposed to the program changes that were initiated through the statutory changes in 2003 and 2005. So we didn't really get a lot of specific organizational information. In terms of coming up with the best place, if it fits within the mission, it is a place that it could live. You know, when it was in the Office of the Governor, it seemed to be doing okay, but one of the problems with being in the Office of the Governor is it's hard to get attention in the governor's office for things other than the governor's top priorities. DNR, Fish and Game, DEC, they all have a lot of issues going on, and their hot button issues come and go. And so what you would look at is the strength of the division and, you know, whether the management is moving it forward. There's whether it be in DNR, one of the things we tried to find was, you know, with the two regulatory processes, the ABC list project as well as the re-evaluation project, we tried real hard to find out, where did those projects die? You know, did it come to a halt in the division? Did it stop at the department level? You know, regulation projects have to go through the governor's office law. You know, where did it just stop? And there's real no clear-cut answer for that. I think I heard Mr. Bates testify, you know, they're difficult issues to get consensus on, and I understand that totally. but you also have to make decisions. And I think with the ABC list, putting a deadline in statute indicates, you know, you have to come to a decision about it. You have to build consensus, but you also have to make a decision, which is one of the reasons, again, you know, in responding to Representative Heron's question about why 4 years, we would consider it probably a shorter than a longer leash, and that is to go back and see, because those are important functions of the division of the program, and those things need to be completed.
Follow up, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, wasn't the ABC list in statute as a time limit? I mean, didn't they, weren't they required to do that in statute? I mean, I mean, if they're ignoring the statute, does it do us any good to put it in statute again? I guess that's a question for us, not for you. But the DEC, as I understand your audit, was somewhat segregated and less involved than it used to be because it's not in the consistency review. So did you at any point in time in your audit see that that was a detriment to the consistency review process, or was it simply that they were on their own track and they didn't have to be involved, and therefore there wasn't a timing issue where they didn't participate actively and then raise questions later? Did that become a function, or was it just that they were disengaged but it didn't delay the process?
To the chair, Representative Seaton, I don't know that we saw any delays because of the DEC carve-out. However, it did play into the lessening of that consensus building aspects of the way the program used to be, because DEC, you know, certainly a lot of the, if you're talking about the coastal zone, there's going to be a lot of water quality issues involved, just inherently. And them not being a participant in the consistency review process. The consistency review process is, you know, sort of was originally envisioned as sort of that one-stop shop type of thing where, you know, all the participants can and review. I mean, there's nothing that would stop DEC representatives from attending the meetings or being part of the process and making comments, but there's real no incentive for them to be there either. And so it's lessened that consensus building aspect of the consistency review process by moving them out.
Thank you. Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
How long is your presentation on HR 8?
Could do it in 30 seconds.
Good.
Oh, yeah, time.
Okay.
Wait, you want to move the menu?
Okay, we'll just bring it up next at some later point. All right, we'll meet again Monday at 1 o'clock here in this room. House Resource Committee is adjourned at 3 o'clock.